Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll tell you why the Islamic police in Kano State in Nigeria are cracking down on sports betting, citing addiction among the youth.
Closing it is also good and it's also bad, because there are things you are going to deprive from a common man that will turn to another thing, and it can make him to start stealing or even stopping people on the road in the night to start collecting their phones and other items. So if you deprive people of all those things, it's going to cause problems.
And out of options, why parents in Lesotho are taking their children, some as young as 3 years, to boarding schools.
We were confronted with a situation where most of the parents here in Lesotho were migrant laborers. That is both in Lesotho, working outside Maseru, and we also had other parents who are working in South Africa. And the challenge now was the care giving for these children.
It's Friday, the 4th of October. First, we go to Chagos. It's a group of islands in the Indian Ocean which until now the United Kingdom claimed ownership over. But after years of negotiations, including a case at the International Court of Justice, which Britain lost, the archipelago will now be handed over to Mauritius. Chagos is of strategic importance, particularly the atoll of Diego Garcia, which hosts a US military base. The agreement allows the base to remain under the control of the UK and America. The African Union has welcomed the deal, calling it a historic political agreement. We've read part of a statement from the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Musa Faki Mahamat.
The significant milestone marks a major victory for the cause of decolonization, international law, and the rightful self-determination of the people of Mauritius, bringing an end to decades of disputes.
Now, my colleague Andrew Harding has in fact been to Chagos and has been explaining this historic deal and its implications to me.
Well, to begin with, there's lots of history here. So the British say that these islands were theirs from the very early stages of the 19th century. So from around the time of the Battle of Waterloo, 1812, 1815, around then, when they took them from the French. The Mauritians claim otherwise. They say that they had a long and established relationship with the islands going back centuries too. So there is, and always has been, a kind of a rival claim to the islands. And the islanders themselves, the people who lived on the Chagos Islands, they have a different view. They say, well, we were independent to some extent. And this has always, I think, been the case with these islands like the Maldives, like the Seychelles, deep in the Indian Ocean, who have often been claimed by larger continental powers, but feel to some extent that they are their own people, their own cultures, and their own territories. But basically, fast forward to the last century, and in 1968, Mauritius, then part of the British colonial empire, got its independence like other places. And as part of the negotiations, the British insisted that they wanted to keep the Chagos archipelago as British territory. The Mauritians weren't happy about that, but they really didn't have much of an option, because the British were saying, if you don't let us have the Chagos Islands, you're not getting your independence. So they gave them up, and the British cut a secret deal with the American government, which had been looking for a while for somewhere in the Indian Ocean that they could use as a military base to project American power deep into that part of the world. And they had their eye on Diego Garcia, so they made that deal with the British and set up initially a runway that turned into a navy port, that turned into a submarine base, and we understand a listening post. And it, over the decades since then, it became a really significant part of the United States' global military profile.
So there's a lot to unpack there in that answer. So let's start by looking at why it has taken so long for this agreement to be reached, where the UK is now returning these islands to Mauritius.
Well, for the longest time, it suited the British, it suited the Americans to have this military base. And although the Mauritian government and the Chagos Islanders, who'd been kicked off the islands by the British when independence came in 1968, although they'd gone to court and there'd been some sort of low-level diplomatic protests, the Cold War and post-Cold War rules sort of applied. So what America wanted, America got. What Britain wanted, Britain got it. The United Nations and these large international gatherings, these were the great powers. So tiny Mauritius really didn't have a say. But over time, as the post-Cold War era started to change power dynamics, with China on the rise, with America no longer the kind of only superpower, relations particularly at the United Nations started to change. The African continent began to speak much more with one voice. In the past, it had often been divided by its old colonial ties, by the meddling and influence of foreign powers. But increasingly, Africa started to speak with one voice. And the message it sent was very clear, that Britain was clinging on to a part of its old empire, and the decolonization process, which is really at the heart of the UN's mission, or a key part of the UN's mission, was incomplete. And so Africa started to demand that this issue and the demands of the Chagossians and the Mauritians be taken much more seriously. Other things came into play, like Brexit. So once Britain had decided to leave the European Union, European nations, which had always either abstained or backed Britain on the issue of the Chagos Islands, started to rethink and go, well, hang on, if you know, if you don't want to be part of our gang, maybe we're not going to back you on this issue. And so it went to a vote at the United Nations General Assembly, and overwhelmingly, the world, if you like, apart from America and a handful of other countries, backed Mauritius. They sent it to the International Court of Justice, the United Nations top court, and that body unanimously backed Mauritius and said, this is an incomplete decolonization process. Britain must hand over those islands to Mauritius more or less immediately. But Britain kept saying, no, you've got your history wrong. These islands belong to us. We have security needs. The Americans have security needs. We're only going to negotiate, if we ever negotiate, once the islands are not needed for this American military base. I mean, it's a long answer, but then things started to get more complicated because things like the Ukraine war happened, and Britain realized that it needed African support at the United Nations and in other big international institutions. And Britain started to be seen as an unreliable partner in that it was ignoring the International Court of Justice's ruling. It was no longer the lawmaker, it was a lawbreaker in the eyes of many. And so eventually the pressure built. The British government started negotiating back in 2022 when the Conservatives were still in power. That process carried on. A new Labour government came in and they decided, look, we've just got to get this done before Mauritius has elections, before the Americans have elections. We've got a window of opportunity. Let's just bite the bullet and cut a deal that will keep the Americans reasonably happy and will allow for a long-term lease on the base, but under Mauritian sovereignty.
The last bits of your answer are quite interesting. Was it then more of a negotiation between the UK and America, and the UK worrying what other people might think about them? Or was it a process that was very central to the people of Mauritius? And without even talking about the Chagossians themselves, who are now complaining that they have not been involved in this process.
So this was a negotiation formally between Britain and Mauritius over the return of sovereignty of the Chagos Archipelago to Mauritius. And it covered a huge range of issues, financial issues, there are issues of how to prevent China from potentially intervening and making things more complicated in the area. The Americans played, as they often do, a kind of shepherding role in this, in driving the negotiations. And of course, American influence is crucial because the military base is at the heart of this issue. Now, it's clear that I think not everyone in America or in Britain was happy with being pushed to give up sovereignty. It was a much easier, happier relationship for America to keep leasing the base from the British, because there's concerns that a tiny nation like Mauritius could be subject to pressure, particularly from the Chinese, that might, somewhere down the line, bring the sustainability, the future of the military base into question. But ultimately, Britain decided it wanted to push this through, and the Americans accepted that. So that's how the deal got done, really very quickly in the end.
What are the next steps then? What will happen next in regards to this agreement?
So first of all, some of the final details need to be ironed out. The deal is done, but the lawyers need to let that deal sit and work out if there are any loopholes or grey areas. And then once that's sorted, there will be a treaty signing. And then after that, it's one of these strange moments, because in some ways this is an extraordinary, historic, hugely symbolic deal. But in other ways, nothing will actually change particularly, certainly not very fast or dramatically. The base will remain there. The process of getting people, Chagossians, back to these islands will take years, I suspect, and be, as I say, very complex. So on the ground, in terms of what we see and what changes, not a lot.
The way you've been describing this story, Andrew, it gives me a sense that you've been to Chagos. Have you been there? What does the place look like?
I went to Chagos in 2022 with a Mauritian delegation that had actually launched quite a provocative sort of, some would say it was a PR stunt, but they decided that they were going to go without British permission to the islands. They basically said, look, the UN has backed us, the UN's top court has backed us, these are our islands, so we are going to go there, we're going to plant flagpoles on the islands, we're going to bring back some Chagossians to visit their homelands. And we went along and filmed that and reported on that trip. I mean, it is stunning place. Your imagined paradise tropical island come to life. These are atolls, so they are coral reefs, heavily thick with coconut trees, sandy beaches, incredible sea life, just stunning.
The BBC's Andrew Harding. So what do Chagossians think about it? Well, Frankie Bontemps is a second-generation Chagossian in the UK and chairperson for campaign group Chagossian Voices.
I mean, like the vast majority of Chagossians, we feel betrayed. We are angry. We feel left down by both government, because since the start of this negotiation, at any time, Chagossians have never been involved. How can they decide of the fate of our homeland without us being involved? Chagossians have learned this outcome from the media, not even from the government. While they supposedly been talking to us, but nothing. And we remain powerless and voiceless in determining our own future and the future of our homeland. So the views of the Chagossians, the indigenous inhabitant of the island, has been constantly and deliberately ignored. And we demand full inclusion in the drafting of this treaty. You know, the so-called consultation that during having, I think, four or five times, but most of the time, all the questions that we ask about this negotiation, they've been very, they said, no, they can't reveal this is between government and government. And we never knew what was happening, but we know that they were talking about the future sovereignty of the island. But, you know, I feel history is repeating itself, like in 1965, when Mauritius was granted independence and the UK created Bayot. The UK gave Mauritius a compensation of £3 million. The only victim in this whole tragedy are the Chagossian people themselves. Why they don't listen to us?
Frankie Bontemps from Chagossian Voices. And now let's talk about sports betting, an activity many youth on the continent take part in. Nigeria is among the African countries with the largest number of bettors. And in the northern state of Kano, the activity is rubbing the community and authorities the wrong way. In Kano City, Islamic police, known as the Hizbah, have launched a crackdown on sports betting shops. They cite the rise in gambling addiction and its conflict with Islamic Sharia law, which is enforced alongside the secular law in the state. According to concerned parents and community leaders in the majority Muslim city, gambling is leading young people to drop out of school. But what do the youth in Kano say?
I believe closing sport betting shop may not be the most effective solution. Restricting personal freedoms can drive activities underground, potentially leading to more harm. Instead, I suggest promoting education and awareness about responsible gambling, protecting vulnerable individuals, and ensuring regulations are in place to prevent exploitation.
Betting is not a good thing, especially for the youth, because it can drain you. But considering the state and how things are going in Nigeria, it's just a business for a common man. That is where his hope depends. He believes that one day he's going to cash out from there. So closing it is also good and it's also bad. Because there are things you are going to deprive from a common man that will turn to another thing. And it can make him to start stealing or even stopping people on the road in the night to start collecting their phones and other items. So that is another thing to consider there. Even in our own, it's called haram. It's a sin. But we are looking at the state of Nigeria. Everything is tight everywhere. Some people are just believing that one day they will just go there with their 1,000, 2,000 and they will make a million. So if you deprive people of all those things, it's going to cause problems.
So what then is the solution to this problem and what are the consequences for those whose shops were found to be operating illegally? Here is BBC journalist Mansour Abubakar in Kano.
In the last couple of years, betting has really gained a lot of ground in Nigeria and Kano has not been left out. You see a lot of youths and young people who are trying to just make quick money getting into it. And you know the economic situation of Nigeria means a lot of people are struggling. So many youth are seeing that as a way out of their present predicament regarding the economic realities they are facing. So actually, it's a big problem and it's a concern by parents who need the Islamic police to get involved.
Who are the people that are participating in this? Is it obviously a lot of them would be youth, but are they employed, unemployed?
Yeah, it's, a lot of them are youths, students from higher institutions, universities, polytechnics. Yes, a lot of them, you find out that they love sports. And because we have sport viewing centers here where you go to pay money and watch your favorite team play, that love for football has kind of moved because they've seen it elsewhere. So they think that it's also a way they can also imbibe so that they can also make that money. So that passion for sports has kind of moved into betting because some people are making it and they are seeing it. So they feel it's something they can also do. Between the ages of 16, 18 to 20, so even their early 30s or so.
The Islamic police are involved to crack down on shops that are conducting this kind of business. Why is it that it's being enforced in that kind of religious point of view, yet we know there are Christian populations in Kano as well?
Yes, the Christian population is very minute. Over 90% of the population is Muslim. And the Islamic police here has been active since the early 2000s. They are very powerful. They have Sharia and Kano, who works alongside the secular law. And they've said it several times that they are not after what the Christians do. They're just after what the Muslims do. And this, according to the deputy head of Hizbah, who I spoke to for my story, they didn't wake up and just decide to go after the betting shops. He said they've been getting a lot of complaints from parents and community leaders where these shops are based. So that's why they decided to act.
If betting is allowed then to continue in the places where Christians live, but not allowed in, you know, majority of the areas where the Muslims live, is that bringing any impact on the social cohesion, you know, among the populations in Kano?
Yeah, so that remains to be seen how they are going to tackle that. But I think what they are after now, for example, where they went to on day one of the raid in Munjibu, it's an area I know very well. So they've been able to close 30 shops there of these kind of things. They said their concern now is to get rid of those shops in their Muslim populated areas.
Who are the people that run these premises and how are they viewed in the community?
Yeah, so what they said is that these people that run these premises are people that required licenses. But when they went to collect licenses, they gave the impression that they would be running video games. which is allowed. He said his bad Islamic police said they don't have a problem with shops where video games are played. But these people later converted those shops to betting centers. The communities where these shops operate have an issue with them because they said young people are dropping, not going to school, just going to these shops and sitting down. And also there's a kind of a feeling of addiction. Say the complaint they've been getting from parents is that their kids are addicted to these bettings. And that's why they decided to take the issue to Hizba.
So when they conduct these raids then, how do those operations look like? What is it that they do with the people that are found operating the shops?
What they do, the first one they did was to kind of, it's like a warning. They just warned them, close the shops and warn those people. They were not arrested. But after that, they said the next one they will go out to do. Then anyone whose shop is still open will be arrested and taken to a Sharia court. So that's the procedure.
In general then, how is betting regulated in the state?
It's an Islamic state. When you compare it to, for example, Lagos, where you have thousands of these shops, in Kano, they've been able to limit it to a certain number, even though the populations are quite similar. Generally, in Nigeria, betting is not prohibited. It's just that maybe you have to be old enough to do it. But in Kano, Islamic religion guides the activities. For example, alcohol, betting, prostitution, all these are illegal, and that's what the Islamic police are trying to enforce.
So how is the community then responding to the police's response to the act?
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Outcry that, you know, betting is becoming an addiction and, you know, the police have responded by conducting a crackdown. What's the community saying about this?
The community are happy about it. I've spoken to some of the people where the areas where they read it and they've told me that it's a welcome development because young people are getting too addicted to it and it's good that an action is taken. Because, you know, as we all know, gambling is a big problem across the world. Even on the BBC outside page, as to when they carried the story yesterday, you could see a lot of people from Kano hailing the Hizba's decision to go after these shops. So they've received it with good thinking.
Abubakar, I wonder how this aspect of addiction, how well it's been assessed. Is it really well assessed to the point where it could be proven that actually there is an addiction going on, or is it simply the community feeling, hold on, this is happening, it should not be happening?
So I think it's basically the community. We've not had an NGO, maybe a non-governmental group carry out research, or maybe a university do research on this topic. But like I said, these shops are where people see them, the community see them, and they see young people that are supposed to be in school there every day. I think that's where they feel that, okay, this is becoming too much. So it's just a case of a feeling of the community and parents as well, who know that their children go to these shops, frequent these shops. They just feel that an action has to be taken.
How strong are these police? How are they perceived in Kano? And is this warning that they are giving likely to be heeded by the people?
Yes, the warning is likely to be heeded by the people because even areas where they've noticed betting shops have been closed now just in fear of the police. They're police that are powerful. They can arrest you and take you to Sharia court, and you don't know how the case is going to be like. So a lot of people are fearful of what might happen.
Thank you very much, Abubakar, for your time.
Thank you very much.
The BBC's Mansour Abubakar. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Would you take your very young child, a toddler for that matter, to a boarding school? Well, in Lesotho, a trend is emerging where parents are getting their children, some as young as 3 years old, admitted to boarding schools. This is because they have to travel far to find work, and often that means relocating to neighboring South Africa. But while solving their problem of unemployment, another issue has cropped up, that of childcare. Most of these young parents need someone to watch over their young children while at work. So some schools have come up with the idea of a boarding section for children under 5 years.
Let's listen to one of such parents describing the experience. She sent two of her young children there.
I'm Makarabelo Makgetha. I sent my children where they were going to be in the environment that accommodates little ones. Since my children have been in the school, I think my experiences have been very pleasant, and I'm highly satisfied with what the school does for our children, not just with the curriculum, but also with the extra neural studies, things like playing chess, piano, cooking classes, and many more that our children do.
And now let's hear from Sepiso Sesioana, a child psychologist with the Child Guidance Center, one of the schools offering the service in Lesotho.
First of all, we started running the preschool, and it is the school that we placed in my home state. Now, over time, we were confronted with a situation where most of the parents here in Lesotho were migrant laborers. That is both in Lesotho, working outside Maseru, working out in the district. And we also had other parents who are working in South Africa. And the challenge now was the care giving for these children while parents were away. Most of them were left with nannies, if that word makes sense to you, and their grandmothers. And the care wasn't so well, as you can imagine, because it is quite usual here in Lesotho for nannies just simply to abscond and leave children with neighbors. So that concern was brought to us by parents to see if we could not assist in keeping them and staying with them. 60% of our children come from single families who work in kind of work that take them up and down out of town, and also some of them basically residing in South Africa. So there was this great need for caring for these children while parents are out trying to make ends meet.
Okay. For perspective here, these are very young children. Give us the specifics, like, you know, what ages they are for most of them and what happens once they are older.
We have children that come to our school the moment they have been toilet trained. The young ones who come here, some of them who are not even able to talk, would actually be taken care and receive a special care by mothers, and they would have all sorts of educational games that they have, and of course physical games outside.
Let me ask you, Mr. Sepiso, what ages are we looking at mostly for the children that are coming to your facility?
3 to 6.
Okay, go on then. How does the day look like for them and for the staff that look after them?
Depending on weather, let's say this is a good day, they'll wake up around 7 or 6 o'clock, especially the older ones. But the younger ones will be allowed to sleep as much as they want to sleep. But the 4 or 5s will be up by 6 or 7, and then they drink water, and then we train them on how to do their beds. And after their showering, they put on their clothes. We provide clothing at school for uniform purposes. And then after that, we have worship with them. Then after the worship, then they have their breakfast. Then from breakfast, then they go to, we have what you call a learning hall. It's not a classroom per se. It's a hall where they've got working stations, and then they go, all go according to their pace as they learn different subjects, which are not necessarily separated, but they, as they play with these games, there will be geography there for them to learn. They'll be dealing with mathematics and reading. They also have a break for snack time. Then after the snack, they continue. Then they go for lunch. Then after lunch, it's physical outside where they play with the football, as you would imagine, the physical exercise out there.
Can you tell us some of the issues that some of these children have to deal with, and probably also parents who have to sacrifice that time so that they can go work and be away from their children What are some of the things that they are dealing with that you're helping them go through through counseling?
Some of the children that come to our center would be quite violent, if that would be a proper word to use here. Quite aggressive, both verbally and physically. And that would be the history that we get from the parents, because we have an interview with the parent about the behavior of the child. So we would have those kind of violence and aggressive behavior, which we deal with. Some of them will be quite withdrawn, probably because they would have been left alone, with caregivers, and they could have suffered a little bit of abuse in the absence of their parents. That would be cases that we also deal with. Also, we do have conflicts within parents, which sometimes we need to intervene and see how we can reconcile and find peace among some of the parents.
So in terms of then the caregivers that you have, what are some of the skills that they need to have to be able to handle such vulnerable group of people?
We have an ongoing training on campus. They must understand a little bit of psychology of the child development and the needs that children have, and also the signs and symptoms that they should observe when the child has a particular need.
Yeah. So you've sort of described for us why the parents would need such a service, that giving the child that stability that they need and not having a caregiver present today and not present tomorrow. But are there cons that comes with this, sending very young children to live in the environment of a boarding school? And how are you dealing with those disadvantages of this?
Maybe it is important for us to understand that children that come here are obviously vulnerable children. As you would understand and appreciate, you don't want to institutionalize the upbringing of children. Children are best kept at home setting. So children that we take care of them because this is a plan B. It is not the ideal situation, but it is the best that we can provide under circumstances. We recommend, we actually not only recommend, but enforce continuous connection with parents. At the end of each month, our children meet their parents and stay with them. For those whose parents are not there, we recommend that there should be relatives who are responsible, who can at least maintain the family connection with these children.
Sepiso Sesioana, a child psychologist in Lesotho. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan and Nyasha Michelle in London. Franny Joey did her bit from here in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was a senior producer and Nick Randell was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga. Thanks for listening.
The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces, and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week, we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.